Hello and welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. Andrew Hahn, what do you say now?
It's Brian Windhorst and the Hoop Collective. You can find it on the ESPN app or the Apple iTunes store or wherever you collect your podcasts from. Please subscribe, rate, and review, unlike Mr. Windhorst.
Still haven't subscribed, don't believe in it. Joining us today from Boston, and that's special, which we'll talk about in a second, is Timothy Bontemps. Tim, how's it going in Boston?
Hello, Brian. It's good. Comfortable.
He had lunch today at his new favorite ramen place, which is in his new apartment. He's now established. He's got a ramen place. Does that make you happy, Andrew Hahn?
Tim, you live in a ramen shop?
Yeah, he does live there. He got a great deal on rent. It was the only way he could get it for less than $6,000 a month was to live in the back of a ramen shop.
There's a good ramen place a tenth of a mile from my apartment, which is good. But I'm not in the restaurant.
And a man making his first appearance on Hoop Collective, I believe, who knows a thing or two about Boston. But joining us today from Austin, Texas, is Kirk Goldsberry. Kirk, did you have a favorite ramen shop in Boston when you lived there?
No, I did not. But I'm happy that Tim has relocated to Boston. It's a wonderful place, a great basketball city. So, Tim, I hope you're enjoying your time up there.
I am. I'm only like 5 seconds from your old home in Cambridge. So,
So, Kirk, let's just, people in the NBA community, I think a lot of people who listen to this podcast will know your background, but could you just give us your thumbnail dossier that you've just recently – you're rejoining ESPN, really, because you were at Grantland before. I mean, I don't really feel like you're a new employee, but you're new to ESPN in quotes proper.
Yeah, so I started doing basketball research when I was at Harvard, living in Cambridge, studying basketball analytics.
Harvard. I'm not familiar with. Is that like a community college or?
It's the Creighton of the East.
Yes.
Right. But, it's the Kent State of New England.
We started doing shot charts there in 2011 and 12, and the Sloan Conference of 2012 sort of changed my career a little bit. And I started doing Grantland stuff on the side starting 2013 before. Making ESPN my full-time career in 2013, and then went to work for the Spurs in the front office for 3 years, beginning in 2015. And I left there this summer and came back to ESPN in September. And I'm great to be here with you guys. But the world of basketball analytics has taken me to the Spurs, Team USA, and ESPN. I'm still enjoying the ride. I don't know where it's going to go next, but it's been fun.
Kirk is an expert in spatial analysis. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, I guess so.
My degree was in
geography and map making and sort of data visualization.
Fantastic. Bontemps got his degree from St. Bonaventure. not as impressive. I got my degree from Kent State University, which I did in 4 years. Not everybody can say that. Thank you very much. Andrew Hahn, he went to UCLA, but it's not really that impressive of a place. So, guys, it wasn't that interesting of a weekend in the NBA, although we had the Marshawn / Dylan Brooks thing. We did a podcast over the weekend about that. I'm not really all that excited about that trade. Should I be excited about that trade, Bontemps?
I would say the emergency pod was more exciting than the actual trade was.
Yeah. By the way, Tim, what day did you start at ESPN?
November 1st.
Okay. Andrew Hahn. Now, I want to just point out, Andrew Hahn is one of the editors. And even though he's technically not your editor, he was part of the editing team that gave you your schedule for the first 6 weeks of the season. I believe you have it there right now. That's what I point out. Tim came to ESPN to cover the Celtics, Raptors, and Sixers. And he came at a time when, like, they were on crazy schedules. Will you please go over real quick I asked him to do this. He doesn't know off the top of his head. Will you just real quick go over where you were for, like, that for your first 6 weeks on the job?
No, everybody settled in.
Just Just give it to us quick and dirty.
All right. I'll just go in order. I was in Boston, Phoenix, Los Angeles, Denver, Phoenix, Salt Lake City, San Francisco, Miami, Orlando, Boston again, Philadelphia, Washington, and Philadelphia back to back to back. Atlanta, Dallas, New Orleans, Memphis, Toronto, San Francisco, Toronto again, Boston, Toronto, Boston, San Francisco, Philadelphia, and then now I'm back in Boston again.
And a partridge in a pear
tree. Andrew, how dare you guys put him – I mean, a part of the reason why he was in San Francisco those times is because you were – that's where you were moving from.
Correct.
Although you still covered multiple – your teams did come through and play the Warriors.
But, yes.
You know, there was a little bit of extra California time. That said, that's preposterous. And I'm happy that you're going to be in Boston for a few days and you can find a noodle shop that you like.
Yes, that's true.
Kirk, were you moved at all by that trade? Does that excite you? Or was it just the fact that there was confusion over the word Brooks?
Well, the Brooks confusion definitely was the most exciting part of the deal. I was wondering where Ariza would end up. I think he's a great sort of addition to a competitor. Are the Wizards a competitor? I'm not sure about that. But I've always thought Trevor was a good, versatile piece for depth in today's NBA. Obviously, really key component of some successful teams in the last decade or so. So I think I was excited to see where he was going. I was sort of not disappointed, but yeah, I'm not thrilled with the result.
The biggest takeaway for me was just that Phoenix clearly was not willing to take on future money because they probably could have gotten something more along the lines of what, say, the Bucks did, right? Maybe they could have even made the trade with the Bucks. That they made for George Hill the other day and gave up a first-round pick to get off of some money. You know, Phoenix has in the past had designs on spending money in the summer and failed to. And the fact they traded Ariza for essentially Kelly Oubre as a restricted free agent, you know, to me, you know, I don't know if that was the wisest use of overall resources on their part.
Kirk, could you imagine, and this is still an outlier situation, but can you imagine having worked in a front office agreeing to a trade and getting the wrong player in the trade? I mean, can you see how that would be possible to happen?
I don't want to be mean, but no. I mean, I can't.
Thank you. You know, you don't have to be. It's not mean. I mean,
there's two Brooks on the team. You have to go in there knowing that and being clear from the start. And I think it would have been encountered several different times in different places along the way. So, you know, count me among the people that were really surprised that this could happen in the NBA. Yeah.
Well, to be fair to Phoenix, the trade didn't make sense as constructed if it was, and I think you guys said it on, I think Bobby said it on the pod the other day, it didn't make sense if it was Marshawn Brooks, right? Like, from the beginning. So, I don't know. That whole thing was just crazy. It was amazing to watch it unfold.
Well, I can see why Memphis was excited about it, because even if they didn't re-sign Oubre, like even if Oubre ends up somewhere else, even renting Oubre for three quarters of a season was value at that. I guess they gave up. I think they actually didn't. They actually get a second round pick somehow in the deal too. There was two draft picks in there.
I think they both went to Washington, but I'm pretty sure the pick that was going to Washington was not a likely second rounder to convey anywhere from Memphis.
Oh, I see. All right. So anyway, there's something interesting happened over the weekend. You know, we haven't talked about a lot on the pod just because, you know, the Kings don't really excite a lot of people here. But it's been a very interesting drama developing between Dave Yeager and the front office in Phoenix, particularly Brandon Williams, who is the assistant general manager. Look, I've been around long enough to tell you that there are plenty of times out there where the front office and the coach are not on speaking terms. And there are plenty of times where, most of the time, 99% of the time, the drama doesn't become public, especially if it's not with the GM. But, this one has gotten public and, there's been a back and forth. There was at first a story that Yeager's job was in trouble. Then Yeager, however that happened to identify, he believes he identified Brandon Williams as the leak to that story. Then Yeager, kicked Brandon Williams out of, or maybe didn't kick him out, but he asked him to leave a shoot around. All of this has been reported. Long story short, there's no love lost between at least part of the front office and Dave Yeager, who has done a pretty decent job. I thought he did a good job last year with that team, all things considered. And, you know, the fact that they're in playoff position this year, is largely a factor of, De'Aaron Fox, who we're going to talk about in a minute. But clearly, I'm just setting the groundwork that there's no love lost there. So yesterday, the Kings played the Mavericks and beat them, I might add. Fox had a terrific game. So did, Luka Doncic. He had 28 points and 9 assists. I think he tied his season high with 9 assists. Everybody knows that the Kings passed on Doncic to take Marvin Bagley with the number 2 pick in the draft. They kind of get a – I don't know. Like, I know it's been a big deal in the Kings world, but, you know, a lot of people, when they think of Doncic, they think of the Hawks – having, you know, traded out of the spot. That's like the legacy. But the Kings have kind of gotten a little bit of a pass. Again, not if you're a Kings fan, it's probably your life, but, you know, it's not something that's talked about as much as the Hawks. But anyway, Yeager was talking about Doncic before the game, and he gave this quote. Perhaps there was an idea that there was a ceiling on him. I don't see it, unfortunately for us. But he's going to be great for them, and he's great for our league. Bontemps, a little bit of shade there at his front office.
Yeah, I mean, a couple things. I would say, first of all, the Kings have gotten way more than kind of a pass. They've gotten a total pass. I mean, Marvin Bagley's been okay, but, you know, I think we're going to talk about De'Aaron Fox in a minute, but the Kings have been awesome this year without Luka. Imagine what they would be like with him on the team with Fox. I mean, that would be one of the most dynamic young combos in the league. And look, I mean, I saw the Kings in the preseason in LA before I moved, and I mean, they were playing like 4 7 footers at once. There were people joking that it seemed like Yeager might actually want to get fired because of the dysfunction there. And, you know,
oh, that narrative was definitely out there.
Oh yeah, I mean they were just it would seem like a complete disaster of a situation. And for things to have flipped the way they have, for the Kings to be in a playoff spot, I mean, I thought they might win 15 games all season. I think they've already won that many or more. It's really crazy.
Their over under was 17. I thought it was one of the safest over under bets in the league. They were so bad in the preseason. And obviously the season's very long, but you didn't look at there and were like, "Oh yeah, there's a lot of upside."
No, it's been incredible. He's been the coach of the year by a mile. It's remarkable what he's doing.
I don't know if he's a coach. I mean, do you think he's a coach of the year, Kirk?
I'm not mad at people who say that. I wouldn't give him that award right now. But okay. I think, you know, they've surprised me.
I would give him it at this point, but we'll see.
The point is he takes a shot at his front office there, and that is a particular soft spot because, you know, obviously that was a, you know, I mean, Kirk, you were there for several drafts. I mean, working in the front office. I mean, draft night is like one of the, you know, decisions that are made on draft night define a franchise. And the funny thing about it, I mean, it's a funny sort of sad thing, is that over the course of decades, literally probably hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent trying to identify a way to select the best players, and no system is perfect. Every system has flaws. Every evaluation, even the best teams who are great at drafting make mistakes. It's so important, yet still so much left to chance. So it's not like you know, anybody's, you know, can claim infallibility, but draft night is so important, and so much went into that decision. I mean, I have to assume that the Kings had meeting upon meeting upon meeting about talking about Luka Doncic. So, I mean, you know, Kirk, you've been there. I mean, that process has to be exhaustive, especially when you're picking that high.
Oh, it's really sort of depending on the team. I think it's a major endeavor with dozens of people, as you referenced, a lot of money spent. With Doncic, I mean, all the European scouts you talk to, though, would sort of wave their hands and be like, guys, this isn't a normal player. Who will listen to me right now? This is the best European prospect we've seen. He's better than Porzingis, you know. the numbers and the way he carried himself and the way he was winning big games as the best player on the court in the second best basketball league on planet Earth.
Plus the Kings general manager is European.
Exactly.
You know, so, I mean, obviously Pat Riley over the years has been criticized because he doesn't like to take European players, although he's had a couple, and, you know, now his point guard is Goran Dragic, but, you know, certainly you would think that a European point guard or a European, GM would be more adept as to what's going on in Europe.
Yeah. I mean, I would have thought so too. It just boggles my mind. Now, I'm not going to say that they're foolish or anything like that, but from where I stood at the time, Doncic was a clear pick over Bagley. Hindsight is 2020, and in this case, I think it's even more evident at this time in the process. But yeah, draft night, I think many of us would have taken Doncic over Bagley for the right reasons. As you said, I mean, you know, they spend a lot of money. They had countless meetings. You got to wonder what they saw in Bagley. Now, maybe he's going to grow into the athletic big that shocks us all in a few years. But as we sit here in December 2018, I do think it's fair to say they're getting a free pass on this compared to the Hawks, for instance.
Tim, that Dallas had to have called Sacramento with a trade offer too, because you know, I can just tell you in the reporting leading up to it, when I talked to the executives, there was just this unending desire in the 3 to 5 days leading up to the draft is, what is Sac going to do? What is Sac going to do? It was pretty clear that Ayton was going to go to Phoenix, but Sac's move was going to determine what happened with Doncic. And so I have to assume that Dallas, if they really coveted him, would have called and offered. I don't know for a fact that they did, so I want to be clear about that. But I would have to assume that they called and offered. Considering that they were out a first-round pick this year, because their pick most likely goes to Boston.
Right.
I would assume that you know, when they made the decision that it was not going to be Doncic, that it was a double decision. One, you have a decision between Bagley and Doncic, or you have a decision if we're not going to take Doncic and there's a value in moving out of number two so somebody can take him, namely the Mavericks and who knows who else, why not trade back to 5 where Dallas's pick was, and maybe you could have gotten Bagley there or somebody else of similar value.
Right. I mean, I'll say that the Kings are foolish, even if Kirk won't, because Kirk is more polite than me. But no, look, when in the couple of days leading up to the draft, the Bagley to the Kings stuff got pretty strong. And by the morning of the draft, that was kind of where people thought it was going to go. And even like you mentioned that the Kings front office is European. It's not just European; it's Yugoslavian. I mean, you know, Vlade Divac and Peja Stojakovic. I mean, that's kind of the Serbian mafia there running the team. You would think a guy from Slovenia would be right up their alley, but you heard for months going back, and part of this is because I was in San Francisco, so you were around Kings people and kind of heard what's going on. You heard for months that they were just not nearly as high on Luka as everybody else. Now, why? I don't know. But they did just, you consistently heard that they were kind of out on him from the beginning. So, you know, they really locked in on Bagley. I don't know if he would have been there at 5. I obviously would have made the trade if I was them. I don't know either. Like you said, if the Mavs called them, but I would certainly say it worked out well. It worked out well for Dallas, and you know, I think Trey is going to be okay for Atlanta. I think it worked out okay for them too. But you know, you just look at this Kings team and where they could be with Luka, it'd be pretty scary. And to go back to your initial question about Dave Yeager, it just feels like this is going to end with Dave Yeager getting fired at some point. Despite how well they're doing, it just feels like this is headed down. Maybe it's going to end up being the Brandon Williams.
Well, or Dave Yeager asking out, because Dave Yeager asked out of Memphis.
Right.
You know, so I wouldn't. And one of the reasons why I wouldn't is because of De'Aaron Fox, who is having a tremendous sophomore season. There's so much about his game that is to like. He plays with an incredible amount of speed, which you see young point guards who are fast, who've like never had a knee injury or, you know, an ankle injury. He plays with incredible speed, but also has finesse. He's become an expert at shooting the floater, and his ability to get into the lane with quickness and then use his finesse to finesse the ball up there, it to me is what, like, that's when I watch him play, that's what I, it really sticks out to me. And I've started to wonder, and I had a conversation with somebody about this over the weekend. Is there a chance that De'Aaron Fox would end up being the best player out of the 2017 draft? I don't think we would have had that discussion 3 months ago. I think it's a I don't think you're going to have an answer, but to refresh your memory, we're only talking about 2 years ago. The number one pick was Markelle Fultz. You know, that's its own thing. Number two pick was Lonzo Ball. So there's two point guards right off the bat picked ahead of Fox. And, you know, there was a whole thing with Ball and De'Aaron Fox, you know, coming out of college and summer league and all that stuff. Jason Tatum was selected third, who I would have said, you know, he had a great chance to do that. You know, then, you know, we had the whole, rookie of the year sort of, I don't know if you want to call it drama, whatever. You know, Ben Simmons won it. But there was a, you know, I don't know. I don't, you know, whatever. Ben Simmons was a rookie last year. But, you know, you have Donovan Mitchell. Well, I didn't want to go down that road.
Yeah, you didn't want to relitigate it. So instead, you right. just, like, said, okay.
Right. But anyway, so without going pick by pick here, Donovan Mitchell and Jason Tatum were regarded as sort of the two prizes. Just to give you the other picks, Josh Jackson was taken by the Suns from fourth, who I have jokingly called Larry Bird because, the way that the Kings or the way that the Suns rejected all these trade offers for him and like to move to the number four pick, I, you know, thought he was Larry Bird the way they were reacting to the way they were protecting that pick. De'Aaron Fox was taken fifth, by the Kings. Jonathan Isaac went sixth to the Magic. Frank Ntilikina, another point guard, went eighth to the Knicks. Hasn't been so great. Zach Collins, who's having a nice start to his career, went tenth to the Blazers.
Wait, why did you skip over?
I skipped over Dennis.
Just skip by the top. You skip by the top two picks in the draft, there, boss.
Yeah,
I skipped over Dennis Smith and Lauri Markkanen. I apologize. I don't know why I did, but
You also skipped past Markelle Fultz and Lonzo Ball.
No, I said
Markelle is in the same conversation.
I mean, I think it's...
He must have been daydreaming because I said Fultz and Lonzo Ball.
I guess. I didn't hear him.
I feel like we would all agree that De'Aaron Fox would be the best point guard out of that draft. Is that a stretch already to say?
I think it's a stretch to make any assumption based on the second year, but...
all right, I'll stretch it. I'm willing to say it. Sure. Kirk?
Yeah, I mean, well, I'll give Lonzo some more time on that front, but... you know, I think Tatum and Donovan are obviously probably still ahead of De'Aaron right now. I mean, that's not controversial, is it?
No. Well,
I wouldn't say it isn't because he was so far behind them last year, and he's probably been better than them so far this year. But in totality, those guys were making big plays in playoff games last year, right? Like, you know, Fox has been really good for 25, 30 games, but, you know, let's see what this looks like, you know, in April. Does he get them to the playoffs? Do they, you know, do anything? Like, you know, we got to give it a little time. And, like, Lonzo last year was better than, like, Fox was not good last year. Like, most rookie point guards aren't. Lonzo was okay across the board last year besides his shot. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of time left, obviously, for this to shake out. But,
now, Tim,
you know,
Fox
has certainly put himself
yeah.
in the mix.
Sure. I think, you know, looking back at these guys in the playoffs last year, I mean, you have Tatum dunking on LeBron famously, and then you have Donovan Mitchell running the Thunder off the court. So those moments stick with me and meaningful moments in meaningful games. And I'm not saying Fox can't do that. I'm saying he hasn't done that. But to Brian's larger point, if this is the difference between year one and year two, and I allow for the possibility to be the difference between year two and year three to be another jump forward. He has a lot of incredible skills. He is fast. I mean, the first time you see this guy, it's like seeing young John Wall. It's like, this guy's clearly the fastest person on the basketball court, and he knows what to do with his speed. And this year, I find him sort of getting more comfortable with that skill set, learning how to cash it in, getting to the free throw line, getting to the bucket. He's gone from a very below average player to an above average player in this season. So if he does that again, if there's another leap in there, like he could be the best player out of this draft. I don't think it's a ridiculous point. I just don't think he's there just yet.
And I root for him because he wanted to go to Sacramento, and it was cool to see a guy be like, you know, a lot of times, you know, we know in the draft process, guys will say, I don't want to go work out for this team, or I want to try to stay away from that team. And Sacramento for a long time has been that kind of a team. And Fox is a pretty bright, interesting kid. And he, from the beginning, was like, hey, I'd love to go play for the Kings. So, you know, given how moribund that franchise has been and how dedicated that fan base has been to a team that has just not been good for so long, it's pretty neat to see this turnaround. And if he can, you know, be the face of a revitalization of that franchise, it would be pretty fun to watch.
Well, I botched listing the draft picks, I know, because I was looking at a list that was messed up, but it's my fault. But so the point is, there were five. I did say Ball and Fultz. Did I not?
Yes, you did say Ball and Fultz.
Okay, my bad then. I didn't hear him, so it's my fault.
Right. Anyway, there were five point guards taken in the top nine in that draft. So Fultz and Ball, although Fultz can play off guard, but he's a point guard. Fultz and Ball, De'Aaron Fox, Frank Ntilikina, and Dennis Smith Jr. Although Dennis Smith Jr. can play both positions. I guess Ntilikina can a little bit in theory, although he's not having a good year. So it is a very point guard heavy draft. And I don't think there was another point guard taken on the first round. I'm looking here at this list.
There was not.
Yeah.
Derek White's a combo guard with the Spurs.
Oh, right. Derek White. Okay. That's right.
G League champion, yes. Derek White. Not sure if you saw that, Brian, but this guy, Derek White, he the Austin Spurs now, but he ran the Austin Spurs all the way through the G League playoffs into a win over Steph.
Monty Morris taken in the second round. Here's a question. Is Monty Morris the third best point guard in last year's draft? I would say maybe yes.
Well, Monty Morris has had a tremendous start to the season. By the way, when Isaiah Thomas gets healthy in Denver, I mean, are they going to reduce Monty Morris's minutes? Because I don't know if they should do that. And I am not taking a shot at Isaiah Thomas. He is no fan of mine. But I mean, I just, I don't know. That's for another day. I think De'Aaron Fox is, this is the first time the Kings have had a player in how long where we're like, wow, like this might, you know, all these lottery picks that they have had year over year over year, they have never been able to get a player where we're in his second year saying, oh my gosh. I mean, it wasn't long ago they had a lottery pick. I don't remember, how do you pronounce his last name? The guy they had a lottery pick and they cut him in his second year.
Oh, Papagiannis.
Papagiannis. Georgios Papagiannis. I don't even remember.
Yeah. Yeah, that was it.
That was in his second year, right?
Yep.
Wasn't that his second season?
Yep.
I mean, this was 2 years ago. They cut a lottery pick in the second season. I think he was like the 12th or 13th pick, so it's not quite the same, but still. And we won't even get into...
That was the same trade that got them Bogdan Bogdanovic from the Suns, who traded up to get Marquise Chris.
Who's also having a nice season, too. All right, so anyway, we'll be talking about De'Aaron Fox going forward. So interesting story on ESPN.com today by Ian O'Connor. He got a 2-hour sit-down with Jim Dolan. Bontemps, how rare is it that Jim Dolan gives an interview, much less for 2 hours?
It's rare. He only does that with certain people. He's done it with my pal, Bonaventure alum Mike Vaccaro, a few times from the New York Post, but there aren't many people he is willing to grant an audience to. And Ian's great. He's been in the market a long time, so he got one. And a lot was said, as always with Dolan, whenever he does decide to.
Well, did you read it? I mean, what did you take away from it? I know what's getting a headline, which we'll talk about in a minute, but what did you take away from it?
I mean, Ian kind of lays out the picture of Dolan, which is kind of a complicated one, because he is... Like, he is this guy that is a fan and he wants his team to be good. And I don't know. He's just always been an interesting guy to me because he's this, you know, obviously he's this reviled figure that as a longtime New Yorker, anybody you talk to in New York is like, oh God, can Dolan just sell the team, please? you know, and he has the thing with Charles Oakley, and yet through all that, he always remains, he always remains defiant, and, you know, he's never going to back down. He's never going to say he should do something differently. And, you know, he's just a very interesting, complicated guy.
He is defiant. Like, Ian asked him some, you know, because he hasn't given an interview in several years. Ian asked him some direct questions about controversies. And he, you know, in other words, he gave himself a chance to, you know, get himself on the record about controversies. And he basically was like, I regret nothing.
Yep. That's his stance. He never regrets anything. He'll never say, I screwed that up. I should have done that differently. He'll just power ahead.
And, you know, he did get asked about the Phil Jackson hire, and he basically said he didn't regret it. And, you know, he said if Phil had a flaw, it was that it wasn't that the triangle offense was impossible to sell to modern teams. It was that he couldn't implement the system, that he wasn't able to get it implemented. He basically said he didn't regret it, I don't think. He said that Phil thought he would have more patience. Phil thought Dolan would have more patience than he did, but he didn't. You know, he got asked about the Anuka Brown Sanders situation with Isaiah Thomas, the other Isaiah Thomas, where he lost $11 million judgment. He did not indicate he was still defiant about that. Basically, said the jury got it wrong. And if they had heard the story and if he had handled it differently, you know, I kind of think that's a tough position to take. He got asked about his relationship with Harvey Weinstein, and he basically said, I was ahead of America and I dumped Harvey Weinstein a year before, you know, all that stuff came out. I thought particularly on the Anuka front, that was not.
Well, here's the quote. I think we didn't defend ourselves well, so shame on us. If I had to do it again, I'd be much more careful about how we defended ourselves. That's really not
shame on us for how she was treated. Shame on us for not having better defense.
Shame on us for failing to get out of this lawsuit without having to pay $12 million for being terrible.
Well, you know,
terrible company.
One of the things I took away from it was he may need better lawyers because he obviously didn't feel like he defended himself that well. And there was another part. He recently had to pay a $600,000 fine for not disclosing something correctly to the SEC. And he blamed it on his attorneys. So I don't know. Maybe I don't think I'd want to be his attorney. I'll leave it at that. But
I would say he definitely needs better PR people and better attorneys reading.
Well, he's swapped out all of his PR people recently. But
kudos Ian for getting these quotes. I just can't believe they got out into the world. I mean, there's just a pattern of these things, and you're just like, why did you say this to a microphone?
This is the conundrum that is Dolan, though, Kirk, because the guy never talks, right? But every time he talks, he says all this stuff. Like, he's actually an interesting interview. It's not like he's one of these guys that when he gives an interview, it's like paint dries over, right? And you don't care. Like, whenever he does decide to give an interview, it's like all, I mean, you read the interview, you know, like it's interesting stuff, but he's a very interesting guy. And
well, for me, the takeaway there, Tim, is like, this is a portrait of a small man with big pockets and a portrait of how ownership steers the fate of NBA franchises. Probably the most underlooked part of NBA, sort of the NBA sort of situation, and by fans and others, is just how important ownership is and can be to the overall success of a franchise. And if you read Ian's excellent piece, for me, that's one of the main takeaways. It's just like, this is how ownership affects a team. You hire the executives, you manage them through crises, you know, you determine the style of play and who gets in the building. And who gets out of the building. And this to me is a story of a man who hasn't been able to do that, at least for his professional basketball team, very well. So that's how I would say, just how important ownership is and can be for an NBA franchise. That's what I took away from Ian's piece.
Just to your point, Kirk, look at the Warriors pre Lakeup and Goober owning the team and post Lakeup and Goober owning the team. And obviously they drafted well, but. You know.
Yes. Well, in that particular case, it's extremely relevant because the previous owner, Chris Cohan, and some of the people that he had underneath him were I mean, like, you know, there may not be a more extreme case of owner to owner in NBA history.
Right.
But Jim Dolan does point out in that story, I think, maybe it's Ian who points out in that story, but it might be, I think it might be Dolan who that, you know, that Lacob got booed when he traded away Monte Ellis. So,
yeah.
So I guess
that sounds like something Jim would say, that's for sure.
There's still time for me, I think is what he basically said, was the point. What Kirk just said, I've over the years that I've covered the NBA, I've had relationships with people who have had to make decisions on jobs, whether they're coaches or general managers. And I've been in a position at times to discuss with them, as they're evaluating a job. And I would say what Kirk said rings so true for the highest level of both players and, you know, and coaches and employees. If you have a choice, if you have a choice of where to go, if you're at high enough level to have a choice, ownership is so important because ownership can't be altered. When you make an agreement to join a team, you know, almost certainly that owner is not going to change. Everything else theoretically could change. And if you're a free agent, if you're Kawhi Leonard, if you're Kevin Durant, if you're Klay Thompson, if you're Jimmy Butler, you know, these guys who potentially can change aspects of teams, considering ownership has got to be a big factor. And, you know, the Knicks are one of the teams. And so, like, if you're Kevin Durant and you're going to dedicate the rest of your prime to a team, whether that team is remaining in Golden State, going to the Lakers, going to the Knicks, going to another team, well, that is a factor. That is a factor. And, you know, Robert Sarver, for example, I mean,
right.
James Jones has a job right now, and I wish him the best of luck. But, there are plenty of people who would never work for the Suns while he is the owner. His reputation is terrible because of the people the things, the decisions that he has made, and some of the people who have worked with him have gone out and told stories. So, but choosing an owner is important. But anyway, the thing that got the headline from this article was that he didn't totally shoot down the concept that he would sell the Knicks. Although if you read the actual quote, he basically said, I don't think my family, who has voting power, would want me to sell it, but I'm a businessman, and as a businessman who has shareholders to answer, you would never say never, which is probably a very smart answer. And also, one thing that Ian points out is that Jim Dolan is a good businessman. The Madison Square Garden has been wildly profitable. He did some things with Cablevision that made it wildly profitable. Mm-hmm. They point out that he invested $1 billion in a renovation. And it probably even cost more than that because they lost all kinds of concert dates while they were renovating it. And the Madison Square Garden renovation, Tim, is fantastic. I mean, it's
unbelievable to see what it's like compared to what it was before. Even though the tunnel is gone, as our pal Frank Isola likes to.
Oh my God! About that tunnel, who cares about that tunnel? Jeez.
Here's what stands out to me. Here's the quote to me on the belief, because I actually hadn't heard this before. On the belief that among some high ranking league executives that he has fielded offers upward of $5 billion for the Knicks. No one has come through with a bona fide offer. You hear numbers all the time. I think people have sent feelers out, but never any that were pursued. Yeah, they are around that number, but these things, it's like a stock price. It's only important if you're going to buy or sell. So if you think about it, the most an NBA team has sold for is about $2.2 or $2.3 billion. That's right around where the Nets and the Rockets were sold for within the last year, or at least at that valuation. So if there's even people contemplating buying a team for $5 billion, first of all, it's crazy. Second of all, you can probably almost guess who the people are, because how many people in the world have that much money? I mean, you're talking about an extremely small group.
Yeah, but it doesn't necessarily have to. You don't have to write the $5 billion check, and also it could be corporations. You know, that's something we
true.
Can see.
That's also
again,
true.
But the thing that I thought when I saw the $5 billion number, that's an interesting thing for sure. I wondered if that included Madison Square Garden.
Yes.
Structure.
Could. Then again, the Knicks are valued at like close to $4 billion anyway.
Yeah, I mean, never say never, because the Knicks are something that would maybe come for sale once in 40 years. a franchise like the Knicks.
There's a lot of rich New Yorkers who'd probably love to own the Knicks too.
Right. I mean, there would be a bidding war. That's why it's amazing that the Golden State Warriors sold for $450 million, I think. Golden State Warriors today are probably
They're over three for sure.
$3 billion. Get their new arena rocking, including the new arena. Like, if you sold the arena with the team, I think you would get over $4 billion, maybe close to five. So easy. I could see the Knicks with the arena being worth $5 billion. But that's the thing. When was the last time a New York team even sold? Like, I saw
Woody Johnson bought the Jets. Well, Prokhorov, actually. Prokhorov buying the Nets.
Yeah. Boy, he got that for a song. He turned that around beautifully.
He basically got the Nets for free.
Right. Well, they just sold again. Joseph Tsai is going to buy him. I think that's going to be over $2 billion. Wasn't it 2.2 as well?
The valuation was like $2.3 billion, I think. And he bought half the team.
But he doesn't actually have it yet, but he will have the whole team. So, by the way, the Nets have won five in a row. We won't really talk about it, but they've won five in a row and playing well.
Interesting game against the Lakers tomorrow.
Yeah, Lakers at the end of a long road trip. So while we have you here, Bontemps, I want to talk a little bit about the Celtics.
Let's do it.
They have won eight in a row, seven in a row. What is it? They've put up some tremendous offensive numbers, dealt with some injuries along the way. Kyrie Irving has developed, not only is he having a great season, but he's really becoming a vocal leader. You are in Boston, so tell us what's going on with the Celtics right now.
Well, the Celtics have played an incredibly easy schedule. I think that is really the biggest takeaway here. I mean, if you go back, I was in Dallas with them. They lost to the Mavs. Luka Doncic went crazy. Kyrie Irving got all upset at one point.
By the way, the Celtics, I forgot, lost over the weekend to the Pistons, so their winning streak is over. The Pacers have the longest winning streak in the league.
They'd won eight in a row before that game. But here are the games in that streak. New Orleans twice, Cleveland, Minnesota, the Knicks, the Bulls, the Wizards, and the Hawks. So it's not like they've been playing a murderer's row. And look, to their credit, they lost the Knicks earlier in the year. They needed a miraculous comeback to beat the Suns in overtime. They'd lost some games they really shouldn't have early on. So the fact that they're playing well, is positive for them, and they are, Kirk has written about their offense. Their offense is starting to look better lately. But after they play Phoenix here Wednesday, they go into this upcoming stretch. They got Milwaukee, Charlotte, Philly, Houston, Memphis, San Antonio, Minnesota, Dallas, Brooklyn, and the Pacers. Like, we get
harder,
to go to 10
not,
games,
still,
and
still
then
harder,
I will have a much better idea of where this Celtics is at. But you look at their overall mix. Gordon Hayward is looking better a little bit every game, which is a good thing for them. They are starting to get into better shape overall. Al Horford's knee is an issue. That's something that I don't think has gotten enough coverage.
They're just saying sore knee, right?
He's got patellar tendonitis.
Well, everybody's got patellar tendonitis.
Right. I mean, they finally called it that. They were just saying for a while he had a sore knee. That's to me the biggest concern. Their young guys starting to play better. They're starting to round into form, but all this to me in the end comes down to, is Horford healthy in the playoffs? And is Gordon Hayward back to being close to what he was in Utah? Which I think by May he'll be there or close. But that to me is their whole season. How good Gordon Hayward is. If he's like 60 or 70% of what he was in Utah, they're probably going to lose in the second round. And if he's 85 or more, then they got a chance to make the finals.
Kirk, what do you, you've analyzed the Celtics.
I got so many hot takes here. I think, Brad Stevens deserves a ton of credit for building the best defense in the NBA over the last 2 years. Incredible. They've ranked number one in defensive rating. They're close to the top now. I believe they're two or three. But if he deserves that kind of shine for defense, then he deserves a little bit of criticism for what I think was one of the most underperforming offenses for the first 15 or so games this year. There's no excuse for this group of players to be the 27th best offense in the NBA, which is what they were heading into, I want to say, November 19th. They changed the starting lineup around, and Marcus Smart and Marcus Morris enter the starting lineup.
Yeah, it was the start of that streak. Yeah.
Start of that streak, and Hayward and Jaylen Brown go to the bench, which, by the way, is, you know, having so many great scorers to the casual observer would be like, oh, this is easy. Brad's job is easy. But I think it took him a while to sort of figure out how to balance these guys. And we've seen this before. I mean, when David Lee got hurt, oh my God, Draymond Green. Some of these right. things are obvious immediately. Some of them take an injury. Some of them take some tinkering in the garage. And I think Brad, however it happened here, deserves credit because, like we alluded to a few minutes ago, their offensive indicators are through the roof. They have the number one net rating in the last 15 games in the NBA, and their net rating is over twice as high as the next team, I believe. They're killing it. Yeah, they've played an easy schedule, and that has to be brought up. However, if they were playing the Suns and the Bulls every night, these indicators would still be very good for this team, comparing to where they were as the 27th ranked offense for most of the year. I think they've traded in a few points of their defensive rating in favor of, you know, just having scorers on the floor at all times. I think when you had Gordon and Jaylen out there with Kyrie and Tatum, there's some diminishing returns. I mean, if your fourth best option on the floor is Gordon Hayward, what really are you getting out of that? You put somebody else like Marcus Smart, who has a nose for the ball, or Marcus Morris, who's having a great year all around. And you just have a better ecosystem for basketball. So I think, you know, this is a story about rotations and cracking a code on a very talented group of basketball players that just wasn't meshing for whatever reason earlier in the season. And I think the coaching staff deserves credit. I think the players deserve credit. We have two sort of prominent players accepting a bench role. We've certainly seen that in the last few years, that not all players in the league are happy to do that. And so I think it's a really good sign for the Boston. And
by the way,
you know, yeah.
Marcus Morris for Avery Bradley, one of the underrated excellent trades the last two seasons.
Ugh. Avery Bradley is not having a good year.
Yeah, he's not. And he's,
well, he's been a train wreck.
He had surgery, had a sports hernia surgery, so he was injured last year. But Marcus Morris has been awesome for them. That guy's kind of
shooting 50 from the field and 50 from three this season, which has been crazy to watch.
And a free agent to be on a guy who was really underpaid the last 4 years.
And as Jackie Mack has said, seems to have really turned things around, you know, after getting some help from a mental health standpoint. You know,
yeah,
it's honestly a real success story from that standpoint. But
I
one thing,
to cut
Kirk,
you off,
real
Kirk.
Quick, to go, I just wanted to ask Kirk a question based off that. You would agree, though, that if Gordon Hayward is like the player he was before in a few months, then that mix looks a lot different that they had to start games early on, right? And I think part of the issue there was that they were trying to kind of force feed Hayward into that lineup when he clearly still was working his way back. And I think for everybody involved, the bench role has really fit very well.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's totally fair. He doesn't look like he's fully back yet. I think it's a long season, and as long as he's looking better and better each month, that they're going to be happy with that. But yeah, I couldn't agree more with what you just said. I think, you know, you look at the jersey and it says 20 and it says Hayward, and you're like, okay, here we go. He's an all-star level player, but he wasn't
right
at the beginning of the year. So I think, yeah, that's totally fair. Whatever the reason, the current lineup, is wildly overperforming the older lineups in offensive efficiency. I credit that to the whole group. But yeah, I think Gordon deserves some credit for accepting that and going to the bench.
He's also paid. There's some guys on this roster who have gotten a little antsy because they haven't been paid. Mm-hmm. Gordon is taken care of and knows it. And I think it's also kind of his personality, even though he blossomed more into a leadership role in Utah at the end. personality kind of is more willing to, you know, be a member of the team than he is to step out.
Some breaking news.
What do you, okay.
There's, the Thunder have picked up Billy Donovan's contract option for next season.
Oh, stop. Breaking news.
That's actually a big deal, I think.
I think it is a big deal. Yeah, I agree.
Why would they do that right now?
They're playing really well. I mean, you're talking about a team.
I get that, but why? It's sort of a strange time to pick up your coach's option.
I have a theory. There's been, and I think maybe the same reason why Kirk thinks it's a big deal. There's been a lot of chatter that Billy at some point could be in trouble there, and I think it's a show of confidence in him with the way they're playing that kind of puts some of that to rest.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think coaching shows up more than anywhere on a basketball team on defense. And there had been some chatter that he might not be there for very long. And I think if you look at their defensive markers this year, without Andre Roberson, by the way, they are top two defense in the NBA and winning a lot of games and seemingly getting better. And in the running for the mysterious who's the second best team in the Western Conference right now, it's Billy Donovan's Oklahoma City Thunder, I think.
Yeah, and Paul George is having a great season.
Fantastic.
Sometimes we see guys, even star level players get a contract, don't always have a great year the next year. But he has been tremendous this year. Bontemps, Kyrie taking on really seems to me to be. I don't know if it's a concerted effort or it's just shining through. Taking on a leadership role, really. Yeah. Doing that. Do you think that's been a positive?
I'm not sure if it's been a positive, but it's definitely been interesting. I mean, I thought Jackie Mack in her story last week on Jaylen Brown really kind of got Kyrie to open up about that in a way he hasn't before. And I mean, look, that's one of the things that's kind of been interesting to watch with the Celtic team, right? You look at their roster, and I think she touched on this on the podcast last week, but you know, the leaders on that team are probably Marcus Smart and Marcus Morris, which, you know, it's good to have guys like that on your roster. But generally, you look at the elite teams, they're probably going to have a guy who's in the near the top of their pecking order from a playing standpoint, be the guy that you look to as kind of the face of the team from a leadership standpoint. And, you know, Kyrie's always been kind of a loner, I would say. And so is Gordon Hayward. Like you said, Al Horford's a quiet guy. Jason Tatum's a, you know, second year player, right? There wasn't like an obvious fit in that mix. And, you know, it has been interesting to see Kyrie take this, you know, kind of vocal leadership role to call out the young guys on the team repeatedly earlier in the year when the team was struggling and there were some clear internal issues with the play of some of those young guys, most notably Jaylen Brown. You know, it's been very interesting to watch. And I'm sure it's been interesting for you to watch as a guy who spent so much time with him in Cleveland. I mean, this isn't stuff that he was necessarily doing in the past. And it's been interesting from my standpoint to kind of see him try to step into that role. And even, like I said, even in that article with Jackie, really admit that it's been a more difficult thing than he expected it would be.
Well, this is what Kyrie has always wanted. He's wanted his team. We've talked about this on the pod earlier. He's wanted this team to sort of, he wanted a team to call his own. And he's so interested in it that he recommitted to the team before he even had to. And he's now doing commercials wanting to get his number retired, and he's clearly, you know, he basically, you know, I'm not so sure he would agree with the way I'm about to characterize this, but he basically wants what LeBron had, which is all roads led through LeBron. He set the tone every single night. He set the tone the way he practiced. He set the tone what he said in huddles. He set the tone by the way he played. He held players to high expectations. I always go back to his first practice with the Cavs when he came back from the Heat. He called a players only meeting and went to every single guy on the roster and told them what he expected of them and what he wanted their role to be, which may have undercut David Blatt, but certainly was not something that Kyrie had ever seen before. And I'm not so sure Kyrie would do that. But, you know, he, I think, would like to have that, you know, that role. I think he would like to be the guy who is attached to winning the championship for an organization like LeBron was for the Cavs, even though Kyrie played a massive, massive role and hit the shot that won it. you would attach that championship to LeBron. LeBron was holding the trophy at the end, and LeBron got the Finals MVP award, and I think that's what Kyrie wants. And if he can do it with an organization like the Celtics, all the better, and I think he's trying to take the steps to put himself on that path. Whether he gets there or not, it's a different story. Before we go, Bontemps, I want to ask you about another one of your teams, the 76ers. Joel Embiid is kind of back, had sort of a weird week. They gave him some time off. He said he wasn't tired, but that he really didn't think he was being used correctly. You were at the game, I think, over the weekend, right, where he went for 40 and 20 or something like that. What was his stats?
40 and 21 against the Pacers.
Pacers still won the game. A great win for the Pacers. By the way, the Pacers defense over the last 10 games has been phenomenal. Even though Oladipo's only, I think, been back for 3 games, he had a great game last night against the Knicks. His first game where he kind of looked like himself. The Pacers are, by the way, tied for second in the East right now, ahead of the Celtics and Sixers, doing very good injuries that they've had to deal with. And they play the Raptors on Wednesday, I believe. So that'll be a interesting game.
Yes, they do.
To see where they're at. We'll see who's healthy. The Raptors are some dinged up with some players right now. Give us your evaluation of where the Sixers are. We know the fault stuff is hanging over everything, but it kind of seemed like they lost their way a little bit with some of this Embiid stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Embiid stuff is kind of overblown, right? I mean, he said some stuff. They have a lot of big personalities on the team with him and Jimmy Butler and Ben Simmons, and stuff's going to be said, and it's just kind of the way it's going to be, right? And even the fault stuff, like, that's a circus, but for now he's away from the team, and it just kind of is what it is. Their issue is they just don't have enough good players, in my opinion. And their roster is very oddly constructed. You look at their team now, they obviously have those three guys. They've got J.J. Redick at the two. And then they have a ton of question marks. Wilson Chandler is their starting four. A, is Wilson Chandler going to be healthy? B, is Wilson Chandler going to be good? The other night against Indy, he got destroyed. I think he played 30 minutes. He had 4 shots. He didn't make any. He went scoreless. Was a complete non-factor. They don't have a backup behind him at all. They're playing Mike Muscala at the 4 behind him. He's really a 5. They have T.J. McConnell's a fine backup point guard, but they've got a rookie in Landry Shamet who's been terrific playing the 2. He's not really big enough to guard 2s. They have Furkan Korkmaz, a guy they declined his option 2 months ago, playing big minutes as their backup 3. He can't guard anybody there. Yeah, he can really shoot the ball, but he can't guard anybody. Like, they just have a lot of holes on their roster, and they have guys, you know, Jimmy's going to miss probably 15 games a year. Joel is probably going to miss 10 or 15 games over the year. You know, maybe this year he'll be healthier, but you still have to expect him to miss some time. J.J. Redick is 34.
By the way, he got some time off, which he said he wasn't tired. He got some time off and immediately started playing better.
Right.
Maybe it's a coincidence, but
it's not a coincidence. Going into the Raptor game last week, he played the 4th most minutes in the league behind Drew Holiday, Kevin Durant, and Klay Thompson. So, I mean, he clearly needed a blow. And, you know, in that all-access Raptor game last week, he was awful. Got dominated by Jonas Valanciunas and Serge Ibaka and just looked exhausted talking about it after the game in the locker room. So, look, I mean, they have a ton of talent with those top 3 guys. And if they can get some depth pieces throughout the year, if they can get some buyout guys, maybe they can piece this together. But as I look at them compared to these other teams in the East, I'm not even sure if they would beat Indiana in a playoff series in the end. Because they have a ton of holes on the rest of the roster. And they're going to have a lot of work to do between now and March 1st to try to fill in some of these gaps. Because otherwise, they're going to go into the playoffs with some really large questions facing them to try to scheme around, even with having 3 potential all-stars on the roster.
Real quick, Indiana Pacers have one of the best front courts in the NBA.
Yeah.
I mean, even down to their bench. When you look at Bojan Bogdanović, who's... I can't believe the way he's defending. I watched him play last night. They smothered the Knicks defensively last night. I know that the Knicks aren't the 86 Celtics, but they just completely threw him out of their game, and Bojan was a big part of it. They have Thaddeus Young, who when he signed that contract with the Nets 4 years ago, I was like, what are they doing? This contract is terrible. This guy is, he doesn't do it every night, but brings it a lot of nights. They have Miles Turner, again, doesn't bring it every night, but brings it a lot of nights. Then they come off the bench with Domantas Sabonis. Between those four guys, they usually get two of them playing well every night. Some nights they have three of them play well, and when they do, they dominate. And then obviously they've got Oladipo. Really good job by their front office to do some, you know, because all of, you know, they drafted Turner, but Young they traded for. Bogdanovich was, they picked up as a free agent on a favorable contract. Sabonis they obviously traded for. Just really good player personnel evaluation.
Yeah, we would have remiss if we didn't say, I mean, they made news today for all the right reasons, too.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Making big news, first female assistant GM in the NBA. But kudos to them and kudos to her. And good luck. I can't agree more. I think we talked about Coach of the Year earlier. That's one of my guys right there, Nate McMillan. I think you gotta include him on that short list right now.
Yep.
And Bogdanovich's shooting numbers, Brian, these can't be. Either they're not sustainable or he is the league's new best three-point shooter. One of these two things. So I would say.
Oh, wow.
Say that,
he's shooting 49% from three?
Well, yeah, the one thing about
can,
the...
Bogey can shoot it, but man, that is crazy.
The one thing about the Pacers is they're a bit of a throwback team in that they routinely play two traditional bigs. Also, they shoot a good percentage from three, but their volume is way down. I think they're fourth in the league. I didn't check the stats this morning. They're updated, but I think they're fourth in the league in... Or they should say, like, fourth fewest attempts. They took a bunch of threes last night because the Knicks played zone against them. I think they took 34 threes last night, which is, they kind of play old school basketball a little bit there. Old school, you know, being like 2013 basketball.
And make no mistake though, Brian, they're winning with, defense. I mean, they're the number one defense in the NBA over the last 15 games, number two overall. I think, like you're saying, their front court is really good. They know who their scorer is. They know who their role player is. It's just a really nice sort of ecology they have going on there. And it's showing up on both sides, but especially on defense.
Yeah. And their locker room, I've only been to one Pacer game this year, but I've talked to people in their locker room. They've got great, chemistry on their team. One of the things I've talked to some executives about is that they suspect that Indiana could be primed for a trade because they have three point guards. They almost split the position in half between, their starter Darren Collison and I guess their quote unquote backup Corey Joseph, but they played a little bit together.
Joseph played 30 minutes last night and Darren Collison played 17.
Okay, well, their averages are about roughly the same.
Oh, yeah, no, I was just going to your point. That's all.
Right. And then they have Aaron Holiday, who they are drafted, who they like their future. And both Collison and Joseph are free agents to be, so there's been some speculation among executives that, you know, maybe they could trade up and get another wing player, trade one of those guards to some of the, you know, to a team and help themselves a little bit on the wing. But they're... locker room chemistry is so good and they're playing so well, you wonder if they even tinker with it. We'll have to see how that develops.
Going back to the point of the Sixers, I really wonder, I think both times you brought this up, is where do they shake out? Are they the number four seed at the end of this? Because the Pacers aren't giving up their slot.
I wouldn't be surprised if they're number five.
Yeah, and the Celtics are ascending. So.
And the Bucks obviously are...
In Toronto. I mean, it would not surprise you if the Pacers are in the top four. I mean, watching that game the other day, you know, it was just one game, and obviously Jimmy Butler didn't play, real big caveat. But when you're just watching the game, you know, the Sixers, if those three guys are clicking, they have as much talent as anybody and they can beat anybody. But they have a lot of shooting issues. They have defensive issues. I mean, it's just going to be a real challenge for them over these next couple months because they're going to have to get really creative. And they really only have, I mean, I don't know if you mentioned this earlier, Markelle Fultz is the only contract they can really trade. They could also trade Wilson Chandler, but they kind of need him as a body. So they're in an interesting spot because they don't have a lot of ways to upgrade this roster. And, like, expecting to get the kind of contributions they got from Marco Bellinelli, Nurse Ilyasova last year in the buyout market, I think is a – a bit of a stretch too, given the historical. Well,
and their front office. I don't know. It's a different front office. I mean, mostly the same guys, but you know, Brian Colangelo is not there, so you're expect. You know, obviously they have this, a good support staff, but you're expecting mid-season upgrades. You know, with some finesse with a young GM. You know, so. I don't know how that's going to work out, but that's a factor. But I just,
and if they lose in the first round, does that impact Jimmy Butler's decision? Does he look around and say maybe I should go somewhere else?
I think for sure it does. I think you're right though, Tim. Like they are, like at their top end, I could see them in the conference finals because their talent level dictates it. I mean I don't have to stretch to see playoff games where Ben Simmons has a triple-double, Embiid scores, you know, 28 and has 15. Jimmy Butler is dominating at both ends, and J.J. Redick hits six threes. Like, that's not
right. Their top end to me is making the finals, and their bottom end is losing in the first round.
Yeah, like, it's quite spread.
I really think both of those are realistic. Now, I think the finals are less realistic, but... Right. I think to your point, you could see a plausible scenario either way, and that's what makes the next couple months. I mean, to me, they're maybe the most interesting team to watch between now and the buyout deadline because they have several holes to fill.
They don't have much to trade. They do have the Miami Heat 2021 first round pick.
Yep,
and they have all their picks. That's probably their best asset. Fultz, they can trade. Whether or not they will trade him is another thing. And if you trade him, do you trade him for short-term help now to help this roster and basically consider it a sunk cost, or do you try to flop him out for another prospect to replace him? I don't know. These are all complicated things that factor in. But it's certainly definitely an interesting team to watch.
Yeah, I think I joined. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead, Kurt.
I was just going to say this team is not very deep. They traded away Saric and Covington, but they also traded away depth. And it's going to show up in the playoffs. They're one injury away from being really thin. And as Tim said, I think, relying on Landry Shamet and players like that in the playoffs against some of these other teams is going to be dicey. So I would say they need to get some more depth, some more talent on the wing, some more shooting to put around these guys because they're not getting it from their point guard, so they need to have wings and bigs that all shoot threes pretty well.
I have to assume that there's been some meetings out there, Kirk, about whether, you know, meetings out there in some front offices about, hey, what will we do if we trade for Markelle Fultz? I got to believe those meetings are taking place and we're lining up for the Sixers to have to make a decision and some teams out there to make a decision on what they'd offer. I just know how the NBA works and that stuff's happening. Well, I really enjoyed this podcast. This is a surprise when Bontemps is here, so I guess I credit it to Kurt Goldsberry making his first appearance. Andrew Hahn, is there anything else that I forgot?
If you haven't subscribed, Brian, which you haven't, it would be great if you did do that.
Okay. I will pretend that I'm going to do that. Thanks to Josh Macri for spinning the dials in Bristol. Thank you for listening to the Hoop Collective podcast. Have a good week and we'll talk to you soon.